It's December 29th, 2009. We're in the home of Robert Stock.
Stock, yeah.
And let's see what else. Oh, the interviewers are Rosetta Graff and Joan Weaver. And we're going to start out with what is your full name?
Robert Keith Stack.
And where do you currently reside?
2316 3rd Avenue in Dodge City, Kansas.
And when and where were you born?
Born in Edwards County in December the 17th, 1925.
And you were born out in, can you describe in the area?
And it was a rural farm community, yeah.
In the north part of the county.
Yeah, it was north, mostly north of Peter and Paul Church out there, that where the homesteaded, family homestead had been.
What were the names of your parents?
Otto Herman Stack and Catherine Nee, her maiden name was Daubert, D-A-U-B-E-R-T, then Stack.
And what were the names of your grandparents?
I had just a grandmother Stack was.
We had Reinhold Stack, was his grandfather.
Reinhold Stack was the grandfather.
Grandfather, yeah.
And Maria Munchaus Stack.
Maria Munchaus Stack. And that's
yeah,
the only one
Munchaus, yeah. Yes. Well, I knew my mother's folks.
Okay,
and
what were their names?
It was
John Conrad Daubert.
I didn't get his middle name in there.
Yeah. John Conrad.
And what was because I had two grandmas.
And they called her Lena. She was Lena Shirely Daubert.
Lena Shirely.
Sherman, yeah. Daubert. Because we lost her, I only had her for about a year, and she died. So.
And then in. What brought your grandparents, or were they the ones that originally homesteaded, your grandparents?
Yeah, they were part of a, I guess you would call it a conglomerate now. The Munchaus and what other names, Lois?
The Dauberts.
Munchaus and Dauberts, and they were among them with the Wagners also.
And they came from?
They came from Germany, or came from Germany through Russia.
Through Russia.
Yeah.
About what, you know what year they came?
Not exactly.
The late 1890s.
The late 1890s, did they come right to Edwards County?
No.
The Stacks did?
That's right, yeah, the Stacks side did. Now, the Daubert side, my mother's side, they kind of strung it out. I think the Stacks probably had a little bit more money and capability of moving, because they came into Edwards County and they came in and had thrashing machines and steam engines and stuff there right in the early 1900s. The Dauberts didn't have that. They kind of strung their way from New York down through, because my mother was born in Michigan, which was kind of en route from New York to Kansas. So.
And they came to farm?
They came to farm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what your family was like, brothers and sisters, and I mean.
Well, there were two boys and two girls. Dad wanted a balanced family, and they just about didn't have for a long time. He finally did get a last little girl, which is the very spoiled one in the family too.
No. Who happens to be in the room.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. No, I was born, and then 17 months.
You were the oldest?
I was the oldest, then my brother's 17 months younger than I.
And what's his name?
Vernon Leroy. Now, he has passed away now. Do you have a year of passing on him, Lois? 1988, he passed away in Amarillo. And then I have a sister, Loreen, that was born in 1929, and she's at Hutchinson now. So.
And then Your little sister.
And then my little sister is the one that creates all the disturbances in the county now.
And her name's Lois.
She has been a school teacher, and I suppose that makes it legal to do anything, doesn't it?
Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to grow up in your house? What kind of a family it was, and what your chores were?
I thought they were a pretty close family. I had that if there are some incidents, like everybody else, I had to walk a mile and a half to school when I was a first grader. You know, that was done then.
Was that a parochial school or a public school?
No, it was a public school, District 38 from Kinsley, that is no longer there. But And it wasn't far. We were only about a mile or something from the school, and we lived right on the road. All I had to do was just take off and get up the road a ways. But one of the little incidents that scared the tar out of me as a kid, as a first grader, in order to save steps, and the little guys, that's a lot of steps. Instead of going out to the road and then walking up, I took out across the yard and across the pasture, through the corral and then the corner of the pasture, and it probably saved me an eighth of a mile or something. That's a lot of steps for a kid. And then I went charging back to the house one day because I saw a coiled rattlesnake out there. And this was, it was pasture land, and I was scared to death. And so Dad come up there to take me out, and he was going to kill that snake. And so when we got back out, went out through the corral and out into the pasture, that snake was still sitting there coiled. But it was something that a cow had left. And so I was late to school.
Now, was this, how many grades, were the grades separated, or was this like a one-room school, or...
No, they were all, it was a regular rural school, had 8 grades there. Out
but
there.
Was first grade separated from the rest, or were it like first and second?
No, grade? You're part of the room, you had to listen when all the rest of them were getting educated too. Okay, so we were in an area where the John Fox family was out there, and the two of the Fox families lived close out there that went to the same school, District 38, so.
What's it like to be in a one-room schoolhouse? I mean, is that a good way to get an
education? Well, it was then, because that's the first year I knew of. I had 3 years of rural education. I had one year out there until Dad lost the farm like everybody else did. And he went back to live on his mother's, on the home place that my granddad had set up right after they started in there. The Stack brothers had businesses with thrashing machines and these big old steam tractors and stuff. And so he had a very nice house out there then, and it was big enough. And we went back to Grandma's house to live through the Depression because the folks lost their place at home. And then we moved into the neighborhood that was where George Krupp and Henry Mankey, all these were cousins. Some Arntzmans lived within a mile of there, and whatever. That was District 9. And
so how long had your dad had the farm before he lost it?
Well, I think they just got it at the time that they married in 25. And then by about, I don't know how long we were at the home place up there, we moved into town, I think in about 1933. I had 3 years of rural school, because when we moved into Kinsley, I was a fourth grader the first year.
You had 1 year at the first school.
District 38.
And then where were you the next 2 years?
At the District 9, out there by this other cemetery we were talking about a while ago, alongside the Lipples and what is it? Salem Cemetery. And that's where a big bunch of my cousins are at, and cousins and aunts and uncles and granddads too. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in the Depression and the Dust Bowl and having to lose your farm and move? And
well, I was too little to know very much about what all went on. I remember Franklin Roosevelt becoming president and supposedly the kind of the savior of the nation. And Dad had been a farmer. We lived the farm life. I remember butchering animals out there in the big old steam pot where they made soap with their lye and all this stuff up here and did all their cutting up of the beef and the boiling the meat and stuff. And then things just got so rough that there wasn't any money anywhere. So Dad went to work for the WPA, and they were building roads and stuff. I remember some out in the Peter Paul area up there were probably, maybe now there might be a bridge or two, but it used to be, I've seen them working out there when they had horses and Fresnos, you know, the scoops and stuff that they built up there. Instead of bridges, you know, bridges were too high, too expensive to make then, and maybe concrete wasn't all that prevalent then. So, but I do remember that in the rabbit drives, when the rabbits got to be so terribly horrible, I never could stand even thinking about going on one of those. But they used to shoot rabbit. We ate a lot of rabbit because it was the handy thing. And I do remember the dusty days and stuff before we moved to town and then after we were in town, because I remember that, what they called the Dirty Sunday in 1936 when mother and had my brother and my older sister then, and we had walked across town to the four station corner there in Kinsley. And we lived over by the Northside Park. And that Sunday up there, Dad had helped Oscar Stinson, who was a truck driver, had a trucking company, and Oscar delivered a combine out somewhere here in western Kansas. Dad rode out with him. Mother went over there to visit some friends of the family that were in south end of Kinsley up there. And I remember pushing a bicycle back because there was too much wind and stuff where you couldn't stand up. My mother was carrying my oldest sister, who was a very small little lady. I remember the dust from being on the farm out there when you could see the clouds coming. And I remember the static electricity. People really hesitated to get close to the fences when they went out to the repair fences. You always had to do something to take the shock off of it first, because it would always shock you when you reached up there.
That's a story we haven't heard before.
Yeah. Well, there's a little more to that, but it doesn't fit for,
I can imagine.
What I need here. But I suppose there were a lot of little puppies that were running around there, too. So.
Did you have problems with grasshoppers?
Yes, the grasshoppers were, they were in, there was the dust and the grasshoppers in the houses, and you couldn't leave the windows open at all. I remember that mother used to have we didn't have towels and stuff, for your chinaware and stuff, for your kitchen towels and stuff. Those are the lighter weight towels up there, and those are what we wet and hung over the windows and keep the dust settling, so keep it from blowing in the house too much up there. So.
And your farm, while you were on the farm as a little one, you did both crops and livestock?
No, just enough livestock that they could get milk and butcher a hog or two every now and then. Yeah, wheat. And then there was not much of that during those years, yeah.
Did you have any chores as a little one on the farm?
No. See, when we moved to town, I was just I finished the third grade in the country. But, well, you had some chores, yeah, but I don't remember, we didn't have any pets because you couldn't afford to feed another mouse.
And they
really
didn't have you driving tractor yet.
No, but somewhere there's a Lois has some family pictures over there. That there's a picture of Dad with an old Ford tractor, an old Fordson tractor, before they had the full fenders on them. And he was sitting up there, standing alongside the tractor, holding me, which I was a pretty small kid then, probably 3 or 4 years old or something like that. So,
what was Christmas like on the farm? We just finished Christmas.
Well, there really wasn't too much to Christmas then. You could get a little bit of bright colored paper and stuff around, and the rest of it was, probably half of it was edible, because you had to kind of make do with what you had. So,
wasn't a good time for Christmas in the Depression.
Yeah.
So you moved to Kinsley when you were in third grade.
Yeah.
And where did you live then in Kinsley?
We lived on Massachusetts Avenue there, right next to the Northside Park. But then we moved kind of frequently because nobody ever paid the rent for us. So,
and this is when your dad was working on the WPA?
Well, he had been a WPA there, and when he went to town, after we moved into town, he worked for Joe Kraft, had a garage there in town. It was a Hudson Terraplane dealer, and Dad worked 15-hour days, worked the night shift, and he worked up there with that until he could get a little more stable daytime work. But he had a lot of years for the nights up there. So.
Well, that must have been pretty hard on you, you know, having to move and not having money. And
were
other people in the same?
Yeah, everybody's the same boat, basically. The one family that I remember up there were the Broadbecks because they had the carnivals. And they didn't have a lot, but they had as much as what we had. And they would have their prosperous season, you know, when for the kids, they had quite a few kids, and they could all of them did something or other during carnival season. And so that set them up in pretty good shape.
Do you remember the carnivals?
Yes. Yeah, over in South Park all the time. So. Yeah, I remember when they first started bringing diesel trains through Kinsley up there too. That was pretty impressive because everybody was downtown Saturday nights, and the railroad cuts off Main Street there, or did at the West End, you know. And it was kind of impressive. When I got to be the year I was a freshman, they had the trains, the diesels were coming in and were new then. And see, I think I was an eighth grader yet. And what was it, one of the Riso's families, the mother had driven across the tracks and got hit out right west of Kinsley. She had her boy in the car with her. And I remember when the Saturday night, that it was just a chill on Main Street. Everybody had heard about it because that train had only gone by Main Street at Kinsley, and within 2 miles had killed a mother and a son, see. But Main Street down there was pretty impressive then. In fact, mother was pretty strict up there. She didn't want us to hanging around the pool halls too much. Evil places.
So as a kid, what did you do on Main Street Saturday night?
Walk up and down the street. That's if you had a candy bar or something, or you could go to Old Man Wynell's dime store down there and get some of the little chocolate kisses down there or something or other, and you could get a few of those for a nickel or a dime and give out two or three to each kid in the family. But they were... And once in a while, if you got enough money, you could go to the theater, which is still there and still. That was pretty impressive to me to see the theater. That.
Yeah, Did your mom and dad go down too on Saturday nights?
Oh, yeah. It was always family, yeah. Yeah, the folks, our folks were pretty strict with it. I don't mean they were not mean strict, because Dad was nothing but an old Dutchman with nothing but big heart. And so he let his kids go. My brother had asthma, and I developed asthma in my about my sophomore year, I think. My sophomore year of school, I worked for freshman and sophomore. I worked for the Arntzmans, lived out north of town. Ben Arntzman worked for the co-op in Kinsley, and I had a couple uncles that had been working in there. So Ben hired me. I was just a kid, but I had a, he kind of bootlegged the driving thing then, you know, a little bit. It was kind of a necessity. And Ben's father, father-in-law owned the Edwards County Mill. And Ben still had farmland out there with Louis Arntzman and the Arntzman brothers out there, Ben Arntzman. And he had a little Chevrolet coupe that he pulled a four-wheel trailer with. He didn't have a truck. He had this car and a trailer. And he hired me to get the grain from the combine to the bin up there. So I got, I was, I think, probably a freshman. And so, but just old enough to barely get a license, which you, and that was kind of a gambling thing then, too, see. But that harvest up there, I showed up with asthma, too, then. So.
Now, do you think the asthma, do you think it was caused from harvest?
It was caused from the wheat dust,
yes.
Because weeds do it and stuff, so.
So then you were going to the Kinsley schools, and let's see, you would have been going to Northside School, right, to begin with?
Well, they didn't have a fourth grade in Northside School the year we moved into town. So I walked from North Park to Southside School for my fourth grade of school. And then the fifth and sixth grade, I did go to Northside. But then we moved around several times, too, and we were close up there. At one time, we lived in a house which is right where the church is there at Kinsley now. It was
which church?
The Lutheran church. And there was it was about, the church is on the north end of the block, and I think we were in about, we were 211, I think, which is, must have been two or three houses inside the block. So, but we used to go down up there when, that was when Dad was working at the garage, and we, mother and the three kids, would go downtown, and you could get the Mr. Goodbar candy bars, 3 for $9. And we'd get those, go down and see Dad at the garage and spend some time with him on Saturday night so it wouldn't be a long night for him. And then we would walk home and we could listen to the Grand Ole Opry, because we had a radio too. And we'd listen to the Grand Ole Opry and divide up the three of those candy bars.
Was this
bars.
A radio in a car? Or a
No. Just a little one in the house.
Radio.
Yeah. No,
oh, no, in the house.
In the house.
In the house.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I'm trying to think what year we're up to. Let's see here. You went to high school. And
yeah, freshman year in high school. They burnt the high school down.
It was your freshman year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was school like while the?
Well, I still got evidence of that. Lois has a table in my folks' house over there, a little end table that I had worked my tail off to try to get the boards of the top of that joined close enough that they were a decent look, and I finally got those rascals together with some dowels in them. And got her stuck together up there and glued. And the industrial arts was in the basement of the school building. And when they have a fire, you know, where the water goes, well, this little, it was a blonde furniture little stool there. It was only about this wide.
3 foot?
about 3 foot wide by a foot and a half out from the wall, and had the water marks right up the bottom, and the seam that I had worked so hard in the seams on the top of it, I'd worked so hard to get them all to where they looked good and didn't look like it was bad workmanship, and I had to bust it apart and do it all over again because it got all water soaked and warped. Yeah.
What caused the fire at the school?
I don't remember now. I was trying to think about that a while back, and I don't remember what it was. But I do know this, since we heard this was December this year, and we're hearing, and I hear people talking about Franklin Roosevelt. I remember the morning of Pearl Harbor, an uncle visited our house, and he said, "Boy, we're in Fort now." I said, "The Japs just bombed Pearl Harbor." And so then the next day at school, we had an assembly. We'd already had the fire, and there was no school building, so we were going to school in the churches. And I was sitting in the old Methodist church back in the assembly room, back behind the congregational seats. It's kind of like a rear choir room or something. But I remember sitting up there with my class up there when I heard Franklin Roosevelt say, this is a day that will go down in infamy. So
they had that turned on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we heard that on the radio, yeah.
And you would have been in what grade?
That was,
41.
See, that was 41. So, but that was, no. I only graduated 43. So I was just a freshman, just in the freshman thing there, see. Is it a freshman or a sophomore?
Probably sophomore.
Sophomore, probably.
You graduated in 43, your senior year would have started in 42. What time of year did the school go in?
In my freshman year.
So you probably were a sophomore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you went to high school?
In the churches.
How many years was that?
My whole high school.
Your whole high school.
Yeah.
Three years or whatever to get the new school.
Well, there's no money and no parts. Even when I got
That's
back.
That's right, because it was wartime.
Yeah, it was wartime. And when I got back from service was when they had the first full graduating class in up there that I can recall. They had some building up by the time that I got to be a senior, but they didn't have... They didn't have the lockers and stuff for the hallway. They had even debated making wood lockers or something, but then there wasn't the wood and stuff. So.
So did you have a junior senior prom, or what was your graduation like without a school?
Yeah, well, they still had those things, but you had to have it other places. You know, the gymnasium was still there. The gymnasium and the library were still there because they did. I don't know how they saved that library from burning. It was that close. I suppose they must have had a lot of water damage. But
well, somebody told us once, didn't they carry the books out while the fire was burning?
It's very, very likely. Yeah.
They had a brigade to carry them out. So where did you graduate? Did they hold the graduation in the gym or?
Yeah, the gym was all right. They saved the gym. There probably had been some small damage, but then it was still usable for all purposes.
And this was in 1943?
43, yeah.
And were you 18 yet?
No. I graduated at 17, and then I wasn't 18 until the following December.
And you were telling us that we're going to try to be in the Air Force?
Well, May of the year, I came up here to Dodge to get into the Air Force here. And they do these exercises to excite your heart and stuff. And mine would not come down on a regular beat. It's supposed to go up at a gradual speed and come down at a gradual speed. And mine wouldn't do it. So they flunked me out. And so...
But this is May before you graduated.
No, this is right after I graduated.
Graduated.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Ted Rennie, he was a World War One veteran, and he was a postmaster in Kinsley, and he had been our neighbor at one time. And he said, "Bob, they'll get you in December anyway." And they did when I was 18 years old in December then, after I graduated. And I registered. They took me. I went to Leavenworth. I don't remember the butcher's name now, the independent butcher that they had in town. Had a couple of kids in school about that my age then.
No,
Wiedenheimers were the old faithful Kinsley person. But this other one came into town, and I can't remember, because the butcher himself went into, he went to Fort Leavenworth with us, because we had the 38-year-olds and the 18-year-olds. We had the old and the young then.
This is
about, it's getting, see, 43 and 44 there, see. So,
did you go to Leavenworth on the train?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Family have any kind of a send-off for you? Or?
No, not really. Just kind of puzzled. I'd had an uncle, Alec Dowert, that had gone to service ahead of me up there, but the rest, a lot of them were on the farm.
And then this was quite a group of you going on the train?
And no, the group up there was not too much. It was about six or eight of us. And they did insult us at Kansas City when we got back. You know, Kansas has been dry all these years with 3-2 beer, and that's as much as we could do for a long time. And when we, there was a boy from Belpre that came in, and I can't remember his name now, but he was my age with the group up there, and there were about, with that butcher, and there were about eight of us up there, seven or eight of us. But we were in Kansas City, Missouri, at that Union Station, waiting to come back after we'd been to Leavenworth. And this was something, you know, we're from dry Kansas. 3-2 beers the size of it. And here we were up there in the Missouri side, because that Union Station is on the Missouri side of the line. And gosh darn it, if the waitress didn't come over and say, "Well, I'll serve this table, but these two young fellas over here are going to have to leave. They're too young for us." Oh, we got slammed back there, that dadgummit, anyway.
They wouldn't look at any proof of age?
No, uh-uh. No, but they took me to service then, and that never did show up in my basic training in Tyler, Texas. And then went to... They could not send you overseas as an individual replacement. Now, I do remember that Lester Frick was a year or two older than I, and he was in service about the same time. He'd been an Andy Kent's fodder. He was the older size of the age group. I remember I was in specialized training. We were on the side of a hill there in Tyler, and I went down there after I had read the Mercury that folks had sent me, and read that Andy Kinsfather was up there, too. Andy's kind of a character, you know. So I went down to see him, and he was down there flat on the floor with his rifle all in pieces. They issued you the new rifles, or those that had been used, and they were all had cosmoline on them so they could ship them and not rust on the ocean when they went across and shipped them overseas. But you had to get that cosmoline off of him here. And I remember Andy Kinsfar, he was kind of a character. He's a nice, wonderful guy. But I'd worked with him at the mill. I'd even helped carry, deliver feed and stuff from the mill and put on his truck route. But here I saw him sitting in the middle of the floor of that army barracks with his rifle, trying to figure out how to get cosmoline off of the parts of it. And Andy, he was kind of a rough character. And when you see him up there with so bewildered, he's just bewildered as we were. And Andy could handle himself anywhere, you know. He's Oscar Stinson's son.
Well, now, maybe I go back a second. You said the butcher, he had children, right? He was older and had children, but he was still being drafted?
Oh, yeah. He was being drafted. But when we got to Leavenworth up there, and they asked us, I told them what had happened with the Air Force up here. They didn't listen. You hip-hop anyway, and they listen to your heart, and they don't hear the things they heard here at Dodge City. And here's this, I wish I could remember that butcher's name, holds up his hand. You know, butchers?
Yeah, they don't have all their fingers.
They don't have all their fingers. And so he was without his fingers. And so they let him go.
So he came back. Or had
some of the, later on when they really got to where they really needed people, then they probably took him then, see. But they didn't catch my thing till I went on to North Carolina and became a part of the 100th Division. And then we went to over to New York up there to so we could ship over. And when we got up there, I had there was just you know, in the Army that there's a head of a department that is a very learned person, and then you got a whole bunch of fellas all training. Well, one of these young kids that was training up there got a hold of me and he says, "Soldier, I don't know what to do about this, but said sometimes your heart doesn't come back on a gradual rate." And I was I was 18 years. I was grinning because I knew I was coming back home. And that guy was a mathematician. This young fella, he was about my own age, except he had been in service a few months there. And he says, "Well, I don't know, soldier, but says when I take your high and your low pulse beat and I average them out, that's a good average." And so I climb on the boat and I'm good for about 18 months overseas.
Now, what time of year was this when you shipped over?
This was in the fall. We went online. We went into Marseille, France. And it was, we had to go to Belfort Gap, which was in the, Ardennes or something, or the mountains up there. But Belfort Gap it was 500 miles from Marseille, France. And we went up there by convoy, the whole division did. And then we went into action it was about the 1st of November then, of 43. Then.
Do you remember the name of the ship that you went over on?
George Washington. Yes.
George Washington, uh-huh. And you landed. Were you able to land at a dock, or did they put you in those landing things?
No, some of them had to crawl over the side of the boat, but it was because the Germans had. We were supposed to go to Le Havre, France, but the Germans knew that we were using that as a loading and unloading station, and they. Of course, they had a lot of air power, and they bombed a bunch of stuff up there, and they had that harbor up there all littered with ships and stuff. Now, we still had, they unloaded a lot of stuff over the side of the ship instead of out of the proper channels and stuff in order to get to there and get out in a hurry.
What was the trip over like?
Well,
what did you do?
Nothing. It was about... I can't remember, 3 decks or 4 decks. George Washington was a big, big ship. I think there were 14 ships in our convoy. And the only thing that made me feel good, I was on one of the biggest ones that was out there because it was a troop ship. And I kept thinking about my cousin, Clarence Stack, who is from Kinsley. And he was on a destroyer escort. And those little things, a drop of water will make them jump. They're so 90 foot, I think Clarence said, because when he came back on leave in Kinsley, he would run. He was kind of athletic, but he would run anywhere. He said he was so tired of that 90 foot long ship. If it's 90 foot from one point to the other, you don't even get 90 foot.
That's not a basketball
court. No. It was kind of something. Since there were no trucks hauling us when we disembarked and got off the boat, and it was about 12 miles out of Marseille that we had a what they called a regrouping area. That we had supposed to get off up there, and then that's when we took the Cosmoline off of our weapons and stuff again up there. Big train on a grade going out of there, and everything in Europe was a different speed. Americans are pretty flashy in most cases. And here these big old trains that take out of there, and they were, at that time, there were a big lot of refugees. There were a lot of African or Afro-Nation people up there with the big smocks on or whatever you call them and stuff. Because they told us, said, yeah, you got to watch, because those people up there have either got a gun or a knife underneath in their big sleeves up here. And said,
had they been displaced because of the war in Northern Africa?
Yeah. Part of it was that, yeah. And then just, Europe was in a turmoil. Everybody's all stirred up, so.
But you went by train then to get...
No, we went by vehicle. We had our own vehicles. We had to wait there for about 10 days or around 2 weeks till we got our equipment. They unloaded trucks and stuff like this. And then we rode 500 miles to Belfort Gap. And along the way there, this is where you see all of the... When we were in Marseille, this was all right. Because the kids and the populace up there, they were being saved. And we were kind of heroes. We were just greener than a gourd, you know, walking up here and marching through the streets and single file, not marching, walking through the streets. But then as you got further out of Marseille and got through where some of the fighting had been, I have told Lois about this. I've seen this so many times, and I saw it on TV the other night again. With this, when they talk about the Brothers film that's been running on TV, we were in the mountains, in the Vosges Mountains, and that's the only thing I remember really. I got into Heidelberg later on, and Stuttgart at the end of the war. I got back to where it looked like country again, but otherwise it was the forest, and I had never been in forests, you know. So, but you could tell when everybody that was gone, people had carts, they were pushing carts with wood wheels and stuff on them, that they were shoving them out, all their possessions of their house. And so I saw these a team of horses. A lot of times there wasn't a team. There was only one horse to a wagon or something. But I had seen cases where there's always cars that had been strafed by our airplanes and their airplanes, too, alongside of the roads and stopped the traffic. And you'd see a bunch of litter out here from the remains from some of this. And I've seen those horses that were a team of horses that were, what do you call it, harnessed together. And one of them was shot, and it hit the ground. What does the other one do that's in the harness with it? I've seen those marks on the ground where this one that was still alive sat there and tried to get up and couldn't get up because this other one in the wagon tongue was hung onto it yet. It just kind of opens your eyes up in a big hurry. So,
was your convoy attacked at all? Or?
No. They were running out of gas, and then we were a part of the Third Army, and Patton came shortly after his little thing that he had in Italy where he slapped the soldier and all of that stuff up there. He came to us, and we're infantry, and Patton, you know, is armored. Well, it's nice to have the armor, particularly alongside of you. So, but then I hadn't been trained around it, and you didn't know what to do. I know one thing, they're noisy. You can hear one of those crazy things 50 miles away. It sounds like, and if you heard tanks, you knew there's going to be aircraft too. So you just hoped you didn't hear any of that. But Patton took over the 7th Army then, and since I was infantry, they always said it was... you know, Patton's got the guts. And then we figured it was the 100th Division's blood, you know, the little things that come up like that. But I saw some good times. We were in the town of Bichet, France, which we have a shoulder patch that says the Bloody Bastards of Bichet, you know, because Bichet in French looks like something else in English. B-I-T-C-H-E, you see. But we did have that on our shoulder patch then. So, but on my 19th birthday is when they had this meat mixture with beans and roast beef or something. But boy, that would give you the GIs. You would run. And out there in the woods, you know, that's not civilization. You know, you go behind a tree and that's it. And boy, I really didn't know. And somebody found out on the 17th of December there in 44. Somebody said, "Stack, I'll tell you what we'll do. This box over here has got all of the canned goods, which most of it is the beans and roast beef or whatever. And over here's K rations." Well, K rations were the dry ration. "Since it's your birthday, Stack, you get your choice." And I took a K ration for choice. It was close to Bichet, France up there. So, but I always will remember my 19th birthday. That was.
And this is wintertime. What's it like?
Wintertime. Well, it was pretty cold. That was this week.
Turn over.
I used to do that, but I'm not up on it now. Everything I've got, I've had no batteries in or anything for so long. Because I've got half a dozen. I've got church services and stuff recorded. I've got a big, big box full of these up here.
Yeah, okay.
Big collection of them, yeah.
Well, what was it like camping in the cold?
Well, a lot of times we were in the open. After we were online a week or a couple of weeks, see, they sent us over. They sent me over. I was trained as a lineman because I had done a little bit of work, climb poles with the railroad, before for a few months before I went to service. So they used me as a communication man, and I was with company headquarters. And we would have to string a wire line from our company headquarters to the rifle company headquarters. And then sometimes they would talk us into running a line down to their observation posts, which is sticking their neck out quite a ways up there to get to that. But I liked the idea because there's... You kind of felt, I felt like you felt would be a little more worthwhile when you had some responsible duties. Otherwise, everybody's got a rifle, and they wait till somebody comes up there and see. And this war was fought a lot with aircraft and with long-range artillery and stuff. I saw a couple of the big, very, very big German railroad guns that are built like on a train, you know, on a track. And they just... I would hate to be anywhere within 6 miles of that thing when it went off, because it would probably bust your eardrums. But of course, they thrive on that kind of stuff.
So, did you have tents or
no?
Just sleeping bag?
No. Well, yeah, if you had a place. A lot of times we would go to a little village, unless there were Germans that had stayed in the area, but they didn't want to be there either. It was wintertime. They didn't want to be there either, see. So a lot of times if we'd stay in a village, I slept in a haymow. I thought I was going to come home one time up there because we'd been in a haymow for almost a week. And it had my asthma stirred up. And I finally, after 3 days or 4 days, I thought, I've got to go on sick call this morning. There's just no other way out of it. And we left town. So it worked all right.
And how did the people treat you while you were there, the local people?
Very good. Very, very good. Since I was just 18, and I was a, well, you can tell I was a skinny 18 then up there. A lot of times there are, it made me feel a little bad because I saw some people that were about my age up there that weren't in service or doing anything. And this was in Alsace-Lorraine. This is, French should be protecting, they do everything else so very good. You go into the woods out there, and it isn't like you go into the woods. You go into the woods in America, and you've got fallen limbs and stuff and all this. Boy, over there, when we got in Alsace-Lorraine, there were wood piles. They do what you call policing. When you police up a place, you just clean it up and straighten it up, see? And they had all of the fallen limbs and stuff that come down. All of those limbs were cut to size and put out here for a stock wood pile. And these foresters, they always had foresters assigned to the area up there, because one of the boys, this was in France, and I thought that everybody in France, I thought they were out of people. That's why we were over there. And I run into a kid that was within about a year of my own age, and he wasn't in service, and that did bother me. I never did have much hair anyway, but then it would have got gray if I had had, because I was concerned about that. Why wasn't he doing something when we'd gone a long ways to get over there?
And you were in the Battle of the Bulge?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You want to describe it's that at all or not?
Well, it's just, see, I wasn't in a rifle company. I was in a headquarters company, but then we're responsible for stringing wire lines down. We chased the, you're always running short on material. And we didn't have wire enough for wire lines, so we'd have to go back in territory we'd already occupied and crawl and go along here. And we had reels, and we had to go along and wind this back up again from where we had been so we could use it next time. It's like one time we had strung a wire line in on a small mountain again, and we'd met some tanks. They were coming down from a company headquarters, from one of the rifle company headquarters up there, and I was a Jeep driver then in the communications, and I had to haul the guys back and forth, or supplies back and forth or whatever. And so we met the tanks. They were coming down. And on mountain roads, there's not much room. You have to pick the place you want to meet them. And so, and I always thought that they could take the outside. Well, they're heavy. They're heavy, and they don't, and second thing, you don't argue with the tank very much. So we had strung the wire line along the outside edge up there so people wouldn't drive over it. And I don't know what it was. It was like a 2-mile stretch of wire that we'd had going up this mountainside. And when we get up there that close and get everything taken care of, and then we hook up the line, hook up the telephone, and ring to get that company, that's the company clerk that's up there on the hillside, and it was a dead short. So we started out checking the wire lines again. A lot of times, since it was wet all the time too, snowing and stuff around. So we'd send a guy out, and he would just grab that, what we called twisted pair, just like your two wires here, except they were a lot thicker. And you'd, the guy'd walk along with that, with his hand over that. And then myself, and because I did this a lot, I was the Jeep driver, and I hauled the guys out there to where they were supposed to be. And I had a crank telephone there with a generator crank on it. And you sat there and you crank away on that. And this guy goes along until he gets a shock, because it was so wet up there, you know, he would always get a shock. Then the Germans knew that too. And so they would scrape one, and then they would shoot the guy when he come up there to fix it, see. But I did have one incident that it's still going to be over my head. we strung a wire line. We had a wire line going from battalion headquarters down to the company headquarters, which was a heavy weapons company. And Captain Einsman was a great big old guy. He was a real born soldier, a big guy, and he had a soldier with him who was his attendant, supposedly. And he was, I don't know, a tech sergeant or something, which quite a bit of rank. But both of those guys were so doggone big physically, they carried a machine gun, and, you know, one that was off of a tripod mount. They used that with the shoulder sling. That's what they carried for a weapon. I even traded my M1 rifle for a carbine, so I wouldn't have to carry so dang much rifle. That other rifle, I think, was 9 pounds or something. And when you carry that thing to bed with you and to chow line with you, you get tired after a while. Here are these guys. This captain and his guy had been startled by some Germans. And they told us to, you know, there's a helmet liner that's inside the helmet itself. And they said, don't ever strap that under your chin up here. I thought that was to keep it on, see? But they said, don't ever do that because somebody will break your neck with that. Well, then because they'll yank that thing back, see? And they did. They also taught us how to, when you get to hit the hoof, you're supposed to have your hands in the air. And they did that to this Captain Einsman and his big old sergeant and probably some little old Dutchman that thought he was, like myself, that thought he was somebody. And those guys stuck their hands in the air, and then they did just like what they told us. When you arrange a set of signals between you and your buddy, and then you just come up with your helmet and throw your helmet, hit him in the face, you know, anything to get out of there. They did that, and then they walked off because the guys dropped their guns to hold their face, you know, the Germans did. This Captain Einsman was a pretty tough guy, and one other guy and I had strung this wire line down to his place and then on down to his observer out, and we were supposed to be finding a case of trouble. And I was concerned. I wasn't on that much of it, but I was back here ringing the telephone so that my guy could get a shock when he found the spot. And Captain Einsman answered on the phone. And he said, soldier, said, I've got a company of men out here. I'm worried about how long they're going to live. And I said, I got one on the line out there just like you have. And Captain, he was a burly guy. He said, soldier, what's your name? And I was probably I wasn't a 98-pound weakling, but I was probably a 130-pound weakling by then. And I said, I don't really recollect. And he said, soldier, if I ever find out what your name is, he said, I'm going to... And so I keep telling Lois that when I get to Pearly Gates, that rascal's going to be up there waiting.
Einsman,
up there.
How would you spell that?
E-I-N-S-M-A-N, yeah.
And I guess I should have asked this. Did you speak German?
I could understand. I could speak a little bit, but understand a little. Christmas is tough on me with these songs up here, because "Old Christmas Tree" is what I learned in school up here. But when I hear "Old Tannenbaum," that takes me back to that Lutheran church out there where my wife is buried and my folks are buried out there north of Kinsley.
That Silent Night too.
Oh, Stille Nacht, yes.
I grew up in a German.
Yes, yeah.
We sang that. Well, any other memories you'd like to get recorded in during this time period before you start home?
The sneeze?
Oh, yes. This is service related. See, I was trained in Texas to be a... Since I had worked about 3 or 4 months or 6 months on the railroad before I was drafted, I had learned line work and communication, which is like telephone work, and because it was with the signal department. And I had followed in with that. And then when I got into Texas, I was lucky. Although I was sitting down there in the springtime when it's nice weather, everybody else was out on problems. They're working out in the woods and stuff in Tyler, Texas. And we were sitting up there. I had a hell of a time in Boy Scouts trying to pass my second-class deal at Kinsley because I never could get them damn radio beep-beeps, right? You know, two dots and a dash and a this and a the other. And gosh dang it, that's what they had me doing in Texas, too. Only thing that was worse than that, there was a crowd of us up there, see? And that, by the way, that's why I never did get past second-class scout, too, because I never did make that.
The SOS, huh?
Yeah. When I had, when we got to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, they wanted to send as many people over there as they could. Well, they could not, I was only 18, they could not send me overseas as an individual replacement. You know, like they ship a half a dozen guys. Lester Frick from Kinsley was a year older than I, and Lester was old enough they could ship him over. Because I talked to him later on. Lester was sitting in the mountains in Italy up there where the war was already over with. They sent him over as an individual replacement. And I was out here running up and down the trees, amongst the trees and stuff up there in France, see. But, no, they had, the sneeze itself. When I was at Fort Bragg, they already had a complement for a communications platoon. So they kept me anyway, but they put me in at a tank. Well, at a tank, I don't know whether they've got any around Kinsley anymore or not. Down by the Kinsley Graphic, there used to be a little gun sitting out there for years. It was a World War I replica. Well, now, up here in our war up here, we had the 155s, a millimeter. And so they put me into that kind of a squad. Well, you got a whole lot of guys that don't do anything until you set a gun up, and then you got a whole lot of guys just doing nothing again until there's some actions. After we got up the Belfort Gap and got lined up, I was still in the at a tank platoon, and they picked up in the mountains up there, they picked up a nice intersection where the road come around the mountain, and there's no place a guy could go if they come around there. And we set up a 155 millimeter gun up there, set it all up, and dug holes down here because everybody was living in a hole. And in the woods, you covered the holes if you could with take other timber and throw it over the top of them, and then dirt and stuff to keep gun bursts from coming down, tree bursts from bouncing down on you. Well, I was on guard one night up there, and we were on the reverse side of a hill. The Germans were over there in a village, and we could hear them. You could hear their mess kits rattling. You could hear the wagon wheels on those cobblestone streets that they've got in all of those mountains in Europe. You could hear that. It's like going down here and hearing somebody. You know, if there's Wright can hear Dodge City, you know, is up here, see? And we could hear that down there. And it's there are times when you swear that well, it's about chow time. You can even hear their lunch gear, you know, their utensils rattling as they're going through the line waiting. And I was sitting out up there, and all of our vehicles and stuff were back in some trees and hidden out of the area, and this anti-tank gun was kind of out in the open. But we had, there were two of us on guard at a time on that anti-tank gun, and you were supposed to be there, and when a tank come around the corner, you'd have a square on shot at. And then there, most usually with you was a guy that had the bazooka, you know, the one of these deals that shoots over your shoulder, and it shoots a small artillery shell, really. We were up there in that area, and it wasn't communications. It wasn't what I was wanting to be in. But then here, you can hear the Germans on the other side of the hill. But this is all right, as long as they stay there and you're here, you know. After all, I may have had some of my own blood over there, too, in this case. See, didn't know about it. But it's, I was sitting out there by myself in that pit that we had dug for the guy to sit in. And you could lean up against the side or whatever. And I heard a sneeze. And I can already hear their mess gear rattling just on the other side of the hill. And you got to give the Germans credit for being kind of smart. They've done a lot of things in this world. And I was so damn scared, still 18 yet. And so scared up there, I didn't know what to do, and then sneeze again. And then it was in the mountains, you know. And then occasionally there was a little flash of lightning. And I know that it's a wonder I've got a neck left yet. Because every time that it lightninged, I tried to make a 360 with my head to see where the hell this sneezing's coming from. And I finally found it. Do you know that sheep sneeze like human beings?
I
saw a flock of sheep out there, and I felt about that big. Scared to death. See, I wasn't 18 years old, see? Gosh, dang it anyway.
Well, how did you, does the war end while you're over there, or how do you get back, or what happened?
It ended. I wound up in, at the end of the war. See, we were running around 35 miles a day, and at that time I was a Jeep driver. And since I didn't have officers to handle, and I was with this communications thing, it was kind of like a worthless thumb at that, because you're not in spot. Well, the troops were moving so fast at 35 miles a day, the cooks had set up a kitchen. They'd go out right at the front, and then by that time, in 2 days, we'd be like, if things worked right, we'd be 70 miles up the road. But there were about four or five of us car drivers, Jeep drivers. We had to go back and pick up the cooks, and then they had these Marmite cans about this big around and so tall that
they about what, 2 feet tall, and a
foot and a half,
two feet tall and a foot and a half across, maybe.
Yeah, maybe that might be a little bit big, but then it's something on that order. But I had a trailer that had a bunch of them, and a bunch of them inside the Jeep, in the back seat of the Jeep. And people hated it, because we always had around 30 or 35 miles to go there every other day. And Vernon Osborne, a man from Detroit, was a good friend of mine. And when I had to go back to the kitchen, he said, "Stack, I don't want to see you go back by yourself." Said, "I'll go back with you." And Ozzy, he was a big city kid. I was from Kinsley, Kansas, you know. There's all the difference in the world. Vernon could tell stories that lead you on for life. But he rode back with me to the kitchen. And so the next morning, we get up early, what it was, 3:30 or 4, and throw these big Marmite cans, a trailer full of them, and then the back seat of the Jeep had it full and had the top up on it. And there were three of us, and with three of us sitting in front of a Jeep, and there is no middle seat in a Jeep. You're sitting over a shifting lever and a bunch of stuff. Well, Jimmy was a little fat cook that wasn't good for much else in the Army, but he was a decent cook. But he was a young fella, and he was very, very pudgy. He was sitting in the middle, and Ozzy, my friend, was on the right-hand side. And it's in the mountains up there, and it's in the coal mining area where the dust is black, and we're driving with those little blackout lights. You don't see anything with the blackout light. It's just that somebody can see you and avoid you, see, because it's even a hooded light, so the aircraft can't see you. and it was just one of them on, just on the one fender. And so we took off, and here's this the guy from the this young lieutenant from the motor pool area was up there, and he was a very impressive young, and he was really actually a nice guy. They'd got out there, and things probably like everything else was, they were running late. I said, man, we got to get going up here. So there's about five of us in line, I think. And he takes off down the road, and I was 19 then. And I was, if you're from Kinsley, you're as big as anybody, aren't you? And by damn, yes, I didn't have a lieutenant stripe, but I was as good as anybody. And I stayed on there. I watched, and I could see the lights disappear behind me from the guys dropping off, because we were kicking up a lot of dust in that cold country, you know. And finally, and I missed a slight right turn, but it was a gradual slope up a hill, and it wasn't a, you didn't just jump a ditch. But I did jump a ditch here, but it wasn't real steep. It was a gradual slope where it had been peeled off of the edge of a hill. And finally, the old Jeep laid over on the side. Well, it didn't roll because we had the top up on it, and those arms kept it. But here's all these cooking jugs that are so tall and this big around in the back seat of the Jeep. And here's my buddy, Vernon Osborne, on the bottom when that Jeep laid on the right side. But Ozzy was from Detroit. He'd been in wrecks before. So I asked him, said, how the hell did you even get out of there? And he grabbed the windshield, pushed the canvas up with his fingers and grabbed the windshield, because his fat cook was on his left side and was just stomping the tar out of him, trying to get out of there. When the Jeep laid over on the side, I caught myself, because it didn't have doors on it yet, there were no sides. But I caught my left elbow on the back side of the Jeep here and the other on the windshield, and then I pulled myself up and out of there. But that lieutenant come back, and he was madder than all get out. And one of the little drivers behind me, one of about four guys or five, they finally got all collected up there together. And they chewed that lieutenant out, said they used pretty plain language. nobody could see at all. You're kicking up so dang much dust on the front end of it. Said it's a wonder they even made it this far up here, because there wasn't anybody else around. That was pretty neat. And I thought then, because it cracked the windshield too, and I thought that I was going to catch a lot of heck for that. But I got back to the motor pool, to our Lieutenant Olson in the motor pool, who's a nice guy. And he just, all he said was, Stack said, they don't make very good mountain goats, do they?
Okay, so how long were you there in the mountains? And
well, I was there until I came back to the States, but I was in the mountains until we went across the Rhine River and I wound up in Waiblingen, right outside of Stuttgart. Yeah. Let me.
You need a break?
Well, there's a silver box back up here. If you can hand me that little silver box.
A silver box.
It's just a little bitty.
Oh, down on the. Yeah. Down on that shelf. I see it right in the back.
We always. You know, when Americans were over at Europe, they rescued a whole lot of things. And deprived them from that. This little box is something that I brought back from Germany.
Well, you brought the box itself?
Yes. And it had some pins and stuff. And I've got another thing here, and I did not realize it until yesterday I was looking. This swastika. Now, looky on the back. That is an actual signature. I knew this man, Hermann Ensel. Hermann,
yep.
Ensel. Mm-hmm. He was a professor in the college in Stuttgart.
And how did you know
he
him?
We were billeted in a bunch of, right at the end of the war, we were billeted in a bunch of civilian houses. And I'll just
this is all over there?
Yeah, a lot of, or some of it, like my Heart Division ring and stuff in there. And that's my combat rifleman's badge, too, yeah. But Herman Insel is the little guy, and he taught languages in the college in Stuttgart. And I had dated with his sister-in-law, actually, his wife's sister. And she was a nice lady. She was a little older than I was, because I was just, that's where I had my 19th birthday, see. So her husband was a prisoner of war in Russia. And she had a little Ermtrot, a little girl. And I've always loved kids. I've always had kids around me all the time anyway. So, but Herman Insel taught languages in the college at Stuttgart. His mother had written, Lois has got some letters.
So you knew Herman from the States? Or
no,
how did you meet him?
Just from over there.
You just met him while
you were over there. We were, what the Army did, they took over about a block or two blocks of this town up here in Waiblingen, and left us in that area up there. That's where we're at the end of the war. Then, of course, we didn't move anywhere. Well, the civilian population, they had to make room for us. And so then we got to know them. And I met people. This family was they're all Lutherans, and I'm a Lutheran also. So there were a lot of things that run all together. But Herman Insel had two kids of his own. They're just small, like second or third grade kids. And Hannah had this little preschool girl. And my family was at home was the same age, see. So we talked a lot to them up there. And this old professor that taught in the college up there at Stuttgart, I liked him so much. He was an older fella, and his wife was like all of the old Dutchy people, like all of my grandmothers and stuff up there. They're fairly pudgy little old ladies, you know. And I talked to Herman Insel up there, and when we were talking, his brother-in-law was a prisoner of war in Russia, so. But then we could kind of talk eye to eye. And I said something to him up there one time and was laughing because I have not had too much hair. I had a lot more than this, but I didn't have too much. And Herman said, well, do you know there is this old German saying? We were good. I got to eat the meals at their house and whatever. I could haul them, give them some groceries or something, and we traded back and forth, and we lived a family life there. But I told Herman that I most of my family, like my dad had a fairly bald head too, you know, and all this. And he said, well, this, it always fits everybody else too. But he said that the Dutchmen do have a saying that, you know, the less there is on the outside, the more there is on the inside. And so I said, you're my man. That's just what I need.
The war was over at this time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you had this good relationship with a German family.
Yeah,
is
that
basically how you, the American troops were treated? Or, I mean, they had just lost the war.
We got some real smarties, you know that? Part of them had earned part of that. I watched this film that's been on here so much this year, Christmas. What is it called? Buddies or something? No, Brothers.
Band of Brothers.
Band of Brothers. Oh, when you see those trees out there, that's all I remember. I was a greener than a gourd. I was so damn skinny when I got over there. And in that first fall, see, I was 19 then. And we get out there in the woods, and one of the rifle companies, I wasn't on the rifle company where you got, and rifle companies, this war was not like the other one where you go over the top and all of that stuff. This is long distance. You're trying to see who can shoot the most artillery shells from here and whatever there. But they had I don't know how to explain to put it. You just got along. Well, first of all, the people looked like I did. You know, if I'd have been in Italy, it would have been a little different. But I wasn't in Italy. And I understood a lot of the things these people were saying. I had some bit of knowledge of the German language. It took me so long to get used to some. Oh, I saw this other movie again here the other night. You know, where the widow had, not the widow, but the lady was out in the mountains up there. And
Christmas Story?
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
That's a good story.
Oh, yes. And I can't argue. I haven't seen people that I would have considered an enemy. You know, they look just like I did. In fact, I came back from service. I had an uncle, John Dalbert, that was in World War I. And he was kind of an ornery pup himself up there. But he was the oldest, and one of the oldest in his family, in my mother's family. And when I got back, he said, "Well, Bob, what do you think about Europe?" And I said, "John, there was a couple of gals asked me over there if I knew where John Dalbert was." And he was real good about it. But I've enjoyed so very much. Yeah.
So, I mean, how did you get home? What was your ride home?
Well,
did you ever have any R&R or anything, or were you always on duty?
No. Well, there was nothing to have R&R for up there. I did take one leave. This was during the war. We were close to Brussels, and Harold Schocke, a friend that I met from Illinois. Shockey and I, well, I enjoyed it later on because at the end of the war up there, Shockey played a guitar and sang. And he had another guy that had a steel guitar, a regular guitar laid on his lap, so he could play it this way. And they were a stringed accompaniment, and we had as a quartet, and we sang over our own little PA system in this civilian neighborhood we had in Weiblingen up there. But no, Shockey was real good. He was going to play at my wedding, but he died first. So.
What kind of songs did you sing?
Over there?
Were they the popular ones?
Well, yeah, there were popular ones, because every now and then, I'll get a real tearjerker up here every now and then, watching these things up here. That's, I'm probably not, I don't have the right spirit toward a war in Europe like I would a war somewhere else. But that's going to be changed now, too, because you know that I am a minority in Dodge City now, too, don't you? Yep.
Okay, so, I mean, how did you get home? Did they put you on a boat or what?
Yeah. I've never been on a plane in the service periods. But I did, I kind of thought that maybe I might like to stay over there a little bit. But our division was put together at Fort Bragg, and it still was fairly new. We had, for instance, the switchboard that we had in our communications center. We were supposed to have a 12-drop switchboard, which means 12 connections. Now, off of that, you could get a lot more telephones than that because you use one wire and one ground return, so you could double your circuits or triple them, see. But this is a small thing. Well, we had a 36-drop keyboard there in Weiblingen, and that wasn't big enough because we were becoming civilians, and Americans are halfway friendly people, dadgummit anyway. So they had, but our division was put together so much. Well, we kept an example on this material thing up here. We had I think it was 106th Division that relieved us one time at one place. And since I was a Jeep driver, you had some responsibilities. First of all, for a vehicle, and then you had an obligation to kind of take care of others. So we always had several people in the Jeep every time we moved from one town to another. The 106th Division come in to relieve us. And we had a guy by the name of Jacobus that drove one of these smaller six-wheeler trucks, not a semi, but six-wheeler, pulling some anti-tank weapons, and those 155s. And Jacobus was, I don't know what he was, a combination of a whole lot of things, just a real good guy. But he was ornery as heck, too. So, and he was a Jeep driver. So we were getting ready to leave this one area. The 106th had come in to relieve us, and we're getting ready to leave out. And I'm sitting up there waiting to find a spot in traffic so I can pull out in with my Jeep and trailer. And here's Jacobus driving by. Instead of that three-quarter-ton truck with a trailer on it or with a weapon on it, he's just got a Jeep. And he's just flashy as hell going by there. And just waved to us. And I said, I don't know what in the devil this is about up here. But later on down the road, we caught him, caught up with him in the convoy. He had the personal effects. Well, what he had, he stole a damn Jeep from the 106 that was relieving us. And it happened to be the company commander, and he had all of this, his whole damn trunk load of clothes and stuff in the back of it. This is how you got stuff. So this, and then when we got to the next stop, this Lieutenant Olson that had talked to me after I'd laid that Jeep on the side. We got up there to the next stop, and Lieutenant Olson looks over the vehicles. It's his job to make sure they're all running. And he said, Stacker, I need you over here a little bit. I want to talk to you. And so I said, okay. This is something, too, when we find out about our services this way. But I went over to where he was at and said, Stack, we got a little problem. I said, we've got an extra Jeep in here. And I don't want to turn loose of it since we got it. And says, tell you what I'm going to do. You know, down on the bumper, it's like a tag number, but it was your own. It told your company and whatever in the number of your vehicle. He said, we're going to put your number on that other Jeep also, your ID on that other Jeep. He said, I don't want to find you suckers parking side by side any damn place around this. Yeah, Lieutenant Olson, he was a good guy there. But now those, that old Dutchman in Wibling, I had talked to him, and I told him up there since the 100th Division was going to, supposed to go to the Pacific, since they had just been over and they had a lot of their equipment and stuff with them. And confidentially, when I was in basic training in Texas, we used the rifle and all of the real rough ways of killing guys, and you'd jab at them with your rifle, you know, and that's all you were doing in basic. Your enemy was a Japanese. And that's kind of one thing that kind of threw me off balance when I went to Europe. But I would have a hard time fighting in Europe again anyway. And I wouldn't have near as much trouble going to the Pacific, except I couldn't swim. Two times in my life, I would have learned to swim in 3 minutes. They didn't give me the chance. Once was before I went over, and once was before I came back. I still can't swim. So,
what was the name of the ship you came back on? You know, remember?
No.
Was it again a big troop ship?
No, it was a Liberty ship.
Okay. Oh, what? Yeah. Liberty ship.
I think it was. What was the capacity there? 1,400 or something.
And you came into what port?
Came back into New York. I saw the Statue of Liberty. Oh, boy. That was nice. That was something I thought I'd never see. When we were at Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, before we went over, there were about a half a dozen of us that caught the bus and went into New York. So I have seen Times Square and seen a few of those things up there, but of course, you only see it, and it's over with in an instant anyway.
So then then you landed in New Jersey.
No, we landed in New York.
And then came
to Leavenworth.
You came from there on a train?
Yeah, train to Leavenworth.
A big troop train full of soldiers?
Well, it was, but it gradually dwindled down, and then you caught whatever service there was. I remember when we come out of Topeka, heading to Leavenworth, and here's this little old creek down here with the timber alongside of it, and it was peaceful. You know, you didn't have to be looking around the tree or anything. One of the first things that kind of shook me a little bit was right after we went online in the 1st of November, I was back, our headquarters, part of company headquarters, so you're back, battalion headquarters, you're not getting rifle fire all the time. You're back here behind it. Now they had a lot of artillery, tree bursts and stuff. The artillery shells would detonate when they hit the top of a tree, just as easy as when they hit the ground. But they had taken a bunch of prisoners. And I don't know what they were. I swear they're sometimes, I think 50 or 60 probably. And it was raining in those woods, just like the brothers thing up here. That's not woofing it. That's the way it was. There wasn't always snow on the ground, but it most usually was wet. In the woods over there in France, they take good care of it because they've got people to pick up their sticks and stuff and whatever. They did until we got over there and started blowing things out of there, see. But they had some captives, some prisoners, and I don't know what there were, maybe 50 of them or something or other like that. And I've never seen anybody quite so miserable in my life as in, like, November and December. We had a raincoat that would shed water. The Germans are pretty dang well equipped anyway, but theirs is a heavy warm coat. And when that warm overcoat, when it gets soaked, I'll bet that sucker weighs a ton. And I felt so sorry for those people. Ain't no chairs sitting around here. There wasn't even any rocks to sit on. Stand there. If you lean against a tree, it's wet. And I was probably a 120-pound weakling or something or other like that. And I remember I walked over there close to it. It just had about 25 or 30 prisoners or something like that. No place to put them, so they bunch them together here and run barbed wire around the trees. And because if you're going to get around under barbed wire, you'd have to get down in the mud. And that makes fairly good sense. And I was just greener than a gourd. That was just a few days after we went online. And the fact that I knew a little German did kind of set me on my tail then. Because I was up there and I felt those coats looked so heavy on those guys. And you saw all ranges of ages of people. See, they were drafting old people and had kids. They had the young people, you know, in their fighting groups that they had. And here's this whole batch of them up here, just nothing but stand still, and there's more rain coming down. And you keep wondering, how many days does this keep up? Even 5 minutes is a long time when you're thinking about all these days. And then one guy is leaning over there against a tree and right next to the fence, and he looked over at me. And I was that skinny kid that's still up here yet. And I'm sorry.
That's us. We're going to need another tape.
Yeah. Okay.